Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I spent the long weekend rollicking through the gorgeous Yosemite Valley, embracing the mighty sequoia trees in Central California. I am back rejuvenated, refreshed, and ready to rant and rave about Russell Westbrook. I hope you are too.
It's good to have you back, man. I saw on Instagram, we're leading with a plug for your Instagram this time. I saw that you were in the Sequoia National Park, and I was actually really, really jealous because when I was in California this summer, my plan was to go from LA to Sequoia National Park, and I kind of assumed that it was like 2 or 3 hours away. Turned out it was like a 5 or 6 hour drive, and I did not have the energy to make that trip. I think the highways were a little bit messed up this summer too. So all I can say is that one day I hope to get to Sequoia National Park, but for now I'm going to live vicariously through you.
Well, not to be like totally on brand with the Ranger Rick talk, but going during the off season, you know, going during the off season when no one else is there, traffic's much less, you could see all this stuff getting in and out much more quickly is great. And also, it's nice up there because there's just no cell phone reception, no service. You're really unplugged and forced to think about life. I think, you know, speaking of no energy, like you mentioned earlier, our last pod, man, that was pretty rough. Like, I listened back to it because I wasn't totally sure how that top 100 podcast came off. I really sounded like I had just picked you up from daycare, but at that exact moment, I realized I had to make you dinner and like take care of you for the entire night. I just had this terrible tint to my voice, like I was the overworked parent, just like, you know, basically carrying you through your day. I don't know why I talked like that. So from me to you, I apologize.
It was a really long day for both of us. One day we'll tell the full story of the Top 100 pod. I think like we had both been working all day and then had to record 2.5 hours of podcasts, and it was just like too much, but we made it through and life is good. Do you mind if I start calling you Ranger Rick going forward?
Yeah, please don't. That's not it.
All right. Well, listen, we need to start talking about Russell Westbrook because what happened was we recorded that Top 100 podcast, and in the aftermath, I was like, man, maybe we were a little bit too hard on Russ.
You were sending me panicky text messages like, oh, we gotta delete the episode, we can't have people hearing us trash Russell all over the internet right after he takes down the Warriors one day later. I mean, come on.
You know what, all I said was that is going to sound very funny after the Warriors game, and I was sort of cheering you on and you were cheering me on, and it was, we were both a little bit too gleeful at Westbrook's downfall this year. But then he followed up that game against the Warriors where he was spectacular and the Thunder looked great. He followed that up with a last-second loss to the Pistons and then just an absolute disaster of a game against the Mavericks where Russ's numbers were pretty much fine, but like Paul George was invisible again. And so it's time to talk about Oklahoma City. I think we've spent the last 2 months or so saying it's not time to panic with the Thunder, but there are real issues here.
We haven't. You have.
No.
I think the other thing that I would say too is when you were having that shaky moment, you know, he had a really nice game against Golden State. I mean, that was his Super Bowl. He played like it. He's stomping all over the court. He's being Russell Westbrook. The best that he has to offer. But you realize it's November against a team that was putting out, you know, 6 or 7 out of 10 in terms of the effort level. I mean, they just didn't bring it. Golden State didn't that night. Obviously, huge emotional advantage for the Thunder. I will be 100% real with you. There are many times that I second-guess things I say on the podcast, probably to the point of fault. That was not one of them because we've seen this guy for his entire career. We know what he's about. He has improved, no question, since the early days of his career, but we know who he is as a player. We know what those flaws are, and those flaws, in my opinion, are holding the Thunder back. There's really no way around it. So I didn't regret any of the things that we said about him because I realized, look, those games like the Pistons loss, I mean, these other games that we've seen along the way where it's been choppy and they're blowing leads late, that is on him to a certain degree. And he is the driving force of that roster and that organization. So I didn't regret it at all, man. And I'm not lying to you about that.
You know what else is funny is anytime we cross the line on the podcast and say something that does veer into like hot take territory, we'll hear from various members of that team's fan base. Like we'll get four or five emails from somebody from like a Celtics fans. But this time we didn't hear a word from the Thunder fans, which I think means that Thunder fans have already sort of like pushed us out of their podcast rotation after the amount.
They tuned us out. There's no question. I mean,
we're not on the OKC radar, which I'm fine with. But so we'll start with a question. Brad just said, we got a couple Thunder like concern trolling emails, but my favorite was from Brad who just said, fire Billy Donovan. OKC needs change. So you think that this is mostly a Russ problem and not a Billy Donovan problem, correct?
Well, I thought that Pistons game was illustrative because after the game, Bill is like, nope, that's exactly what I wanted to do. We are down one, and I wanted Russell to get the inbounds pass and chuck up a three-pointer from a step behind the three-point line, you know, trying to play just very stereotypical hero ball, and Billy didn't walk away from it. That shows you exactly what kind of a spot coaches are in the NBA. I mean, look back at his college career, how his teams played, how he built his reputation. I guarantee you Florida did not win titles in the NCAA by jacking 35-foot three-pointers when they only needed a two. That's not how it went down. But when you're an NBA coach, you have to stand up for your stars. We saw that with Memphis just this week. I mean, Fizdale gets popped by the front office because there's a little tension between him and Marc Gasol. At the first time of that spilling over publicly, he's gone. So you are only as good as your stars in the NBA. I think we all know that. And I think with Westbrook, my big philosophical takeaway about Westbrook, and you're probably going to snicker, you're probably going to laugh about this, but as I was sitting in the forest, really thinking deeply, kind of having my Bill Walton moment, I was going over my John Wooden pyramid of success and all these various things. Westbrook plays with purpose. There's no question. He goes so hard. He puts everything he has on the line. Consistency-wise, he will give it to you. He doesn't take nights off. He will try to break you physically. He will try to break you mentally. He has the utmost self-confidence. My question is, does Russell Westbrook play with a purpose? Does he have a vision that's bigger than himself, that takes into account the other nine players who are on the court at that time, that takes into account his entire organization, that takes into account where basketball is headed, how he should be playing, what the best practices are around the league? That's what I question. He plays with purpose. He doesn't play with a purpose.
Well, I think the counter to that would be that Westbrook believes that him playing his game at 110% is the best chance for his team to win. And I just don't think he's correct on that one. Like you mentioned the piston shot. The piston shot at the end, where for people who didn't see, basically there were 5 seconds left. Russ gets the inbounds pass. And then he kind of like rushed the shot. It wasn't just hero ball. Like he was off balance, and it just like the shot made me physically cringe when I watched it because it was just so reckless, and he had a little bit more time than he used on that one. And that's the type of shot that like last year he took those and they went in, and this year they're not, and that's part of the problem for the Thunder, which is pretty basic.
They went in sometimes, not all the time. I mean, you look back at the stats, like three-point shots in clutch situations, not necessarily his specialty. Three-point shots in general, not his specialty. There's no possible defense for that being the best shot that they could possibly get. And hopefully, everyone in Oklahoma City knows that. The question is, does Westbrook? And I don't think Westbrook does, and I agree with what you just said. He sees his vision as best for the team. That is not playing with a purpose. That is not a situation where everyone is able to succeed, you know, to their own best abilities. That's a very anti-Spurs-like approach. I mean, can you imagine if a guy like Tim Duncan was like, you know what, I'm going out there and I'm trying to get 40 and 20 every night. Never.
Now I am going to make fun of you. No, look, my thing is, and we got into it a little bit on the Top 100 podcast, I said that it feels like we're beyond the point of no return with Westbrook. Like last year's MVP year was a tipping point for him. And what I meant there was that like when it was Russ and KD, it was 1A and 1B, and they would trade off responsibilities in those bigger moments. And now I don't like Paul George is very close to being as good as Kevin Durant is, but I don't think Russ has it in him to do the 1A, 1B thing anymore. And it's always going to be Westbrook in those moments. And that's not, he's not good enough to be on a 55 win team playing that role.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be a brat here. It was a 1A and 1B. KD was 1. He was
KD was better. KD was better, but Russ still took more shots a lot of the time.
And KD and Paul George, there's a comparison. They're both really good basketball players. KD is on a much different level than Paul George. And I understand that he is not the popular figure right now around the NBA blogosphere. I totally get that, you know, in terms of Durant. Durant is an amazing, amazing all-around player. And when you look back at their era shared together, there is no question to me that Durant was more critical to winning throughout that time period than Westbrook. He might not be that prototypical leader. He might not have that personality that people rally to. On the court, he was the guy who got that done. And, you know, you can't expect Paul George to replicate that. And I don't think that that should have ever really been the plan. And I think that's one reason, honestly, why they traded for Melo, because if they had had these similar kind of struggles where the balance didn't quite work and they had never traded for Melo, that would have been a lot of scrutiny on Paul George. And it would have been a situation where maybe he winds up, you know, he's the new face. He's the one not fitting in. So he catches the backlash. Right now with the three stars, at least you've spread that out a little bit in terms of like the finger pointing and the blaming, but that doesn't really get you anywhere. I mean, that doesn't help you keep Paul George for the long term. And so to me, every question that I had about these guys has come to fruition. And it's not just that three-pointer against Detroit, by the way. We're harping about that because it was so obvious. These guys take so many contested shots, so many bad contested twos.
Yeah.
They settle constantly. They don't move the ball. Billy does these like little three-man weave type actions at the beginning of possessions to just try to encourage them to pass the ball at all. And it winds up, you know, really, they're just kind of going through the motions. A lot of time they're not getting themselves good switches or into better positions. They just don't commit to it. And again, it goes back to what's Westbrook's purpose. He always talks about how he loves the basketball. The basketball is his friend. He's always, you know, kamikazing towards the rim. That's great. I mean, that's not necessarily how this sport is played at the ultra, ultra high level. You can win. You can win 50 games. You can win 45 games. You can make the playoffs, even in the West, doing it that way. But you're not going to get farther than that with this mentality.
I think that's the real issue, is that you can be a good team if your best player is playing the way Westbrook's playing, but the Thunder this year are coming in expecting to win 55 or 60 games, and you're not going to do that with a lead superstar like Westbrook. It just, like, you need to share some of the responsibilities. And your point on Paul George is dead on. He's when I say he's KD, like he's about 85% of KD. And he really has, thus far, made you appreciate how great Durant was, because Durant was able to go off for 25 or 30 a game on like maybe half the touches he should have been getting. And he was able to just sort of pick his spots and still be dominant every time he was on the floor next to Westbrook. And Paul George, what you're seeing is like he needs a little bit more help getting into a rhythm and playing off the ball. And I, to be honest with you, I expected him to be a little better in this role than he has been, but that's the difference, is that he's not as like brutally efficient as Durant was. And you know, big picture, that Golden State game
too. You know, he's got some bad habits, and that's the thing. He's not a perfect player, and so again, if you have a point guard who's trying to make him better, you wean him off those bad habits. You don't let him settle for those long twos. You get him going towards the basket off of cuts more often. You know, you find him in rhythm, in transition for catch and shoot three pointers to kind of get him going. You just keep him involved constantly, and that hasn't really been the case.
Yeah, big picture, I have two thoughts. First, that Golden State game is a good example of why we shouldn't freak out too much, because in a playoff series, they still have they're still going to have most of the best athletes on the floor, and they're going to be really tough to deal with. Like, I keep seeing people compare the Thunder to the 2010 Lakers with Dwight and Steve Nash and Kobe, and it's just, it's a different dynamic because Paul George is still, like, smack in the middle of his prime. Same deal with Westbrook. Melo's not, but, like, Roberson is. Steven Adams is. Like, they are going to be a pain in the ass for any team to deal with in the playoffs. It's going to be an adventure getting there, though.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I kind of had the opposite takeaway. Like, if they face Golden State in the playoffs, you just circle so many of those guys as matchup problems. And even though they won big, and they have an awesome home court, and that home court definitely played a role in that game on Wednesday, there's no doubt. I still see all those little isolation guys who you can pick on, Melo, Roberson in certain situations. When they go to their bench, basically everybody who's coming in off that bench can be picked on. And then Westbrook himself can be made to pay for his gambling on defense, for some of his erratic decision-making on offense. And then I think they're really going to sucker him into trying to, you know, bait him into beating them with his outside shot. He's not going to be able to do it. So to me, I came away from that undaunted in terms of Golden State and Oklahoma City, how they match up in the playoffs. And, you know, that matchup may not come. I mean, depending on how the season, the seedings go, we might not get that showdown, which is what really everybody wants, I think.
Well, just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that they're going to beat the Warriors, but I'm saying that, like, if they're matched up with a team like the Nuggets or the Blazers in the first round, like, the drama of late November is not going to matter in late April, because they're still going to have better athletes and more talent, and that's what wins in the playoffs. But I will, as far as suckering Russ into threes, it's funny because I had to write a little blurb on him for the year-end issue of Sports Illustrated, and I found myself revisiting that Rocket series. We didn't really talk enough about how fucking crazy his final game against the Rockets was. He took 18 threes. He was 5 of 18 from 3 in that game. And I think he finished with like 48 points. But it truly was, it was like a comic book hero going down in a hail of bullets. Like, it was just unreal.
Okay, I got to really, you know, pick a beef with you here. Stop using the royal we, okay?
All right,
I did talk about that. I was crushing Westbrook for martyr ball the whole way through.
That's
the postseason.
We did talk about it.
MVP session. No, it was ridiculous, but it kind of goes back to why he's such an interesting character in all of this, because he has got a base that will never leave him, and I totally get it, and I totally respect it. And that base is saying, look, I'm not necessarily sure Westbrook can lead us to a title, but man, this guy is awesome. I roll with him. I'd rather have someone who conducts himself like Westbrook does, very authentically, than someone like KD, who's doing this like awkward like clapping and like trash talking in that game on Wednesday. And it was a weird look for Durant. There's no excusing it. There's no getting around it. It was very, very awkward. So I can totally understand why his base would never leave him. And I'm not even sure that we're necessarily saying they should. You know, go ahead and love Westbrook. There's a lot of elements to his game that I enjoy watching. But to me, he is his own worst enemy. He is holding himself back from greater postseason glory by his inability to evolve here a little bit on offense. And I don't know what the counter argument to that is. We've seen it enough. We've seen him with enough different combinations of teammates. We've seen him with enough different coaches. And so going back to Brad's question about fire Billy Donovan, I mean, what are you going to do? Who are you going to put in there that's going to solve this situation and coax something out of Westbrook that has never been coaxed out of him before? I just don't see it.
Yeah, I don't think he can play a different way. That's why I don't really look at it as a criticism of Russ. I think this is just the way he's wired, and you take the good with the bad. And again, if he's your best player, that puts a ceiling on what you can be as a team. And I think we're seeing that this year. And you're right that it's been this way with Scott Brooks. It's been this way with Durant. It's been this way without Durant, with Paul George. Like, Russ is the baseline to all of these issues. The KD thing was interesting, though, because watching him, I don't know, like, the way Russ has handled Durant the last 2 years has been kind of corny to me. And watching KD lose to the Thunder on Wednesday was like the first time in a while I've looked at him as a like genuinely sympathetic figure, and I was kind of rooting for him to go off in that second half. And obviously it didn't happen, but it did sort of remind me that like the one way Durant can win people over again is if he's actually pushed and actually tested and comes through, which is what happened with LeBron and the Spurs. And that's the thing that like I don't think he's ever going to get that in Golden State, which is the problem.
Yeah. I mean, we're all kind of waiting for who that team is going to be. I mean, even with Cleveland's recent hot streak, I mean, I know you were ready to write them off by Halloween, but, you know, guess what? They're back. Even with Cleveland getting like career level play from LeBron and, you know, everything else, 8-game winning streak, whatever it might be. I mean, there still seems like there's a real gap there. So I don't know who it is that's going to push them in. And I definitely hear what you're saying. And by the way, does Golden State self-sabotage a little bit because of that? Like, are they looking for teams to kind of challenge them? They dig themselves these like 10, 15, 20 point holes just to kind of see if they can dig out of it. That drives me nuts. I hope they quit it. That's what got them in trouble 2 years ago during that 73-win season during the playoffs. They kept self-sabotaging, and that's a bad habit. And Steve Kerr has got to find a way to break that.
Yeah, the Warriors have really been annoying you. You've been sort of venting to me offline all year long because they do kind of screw around. Like, I watched them against the Pelicans the other night, and the first half, like, honest to God, it looked like they were playing pickup basketball, and some of the shots that they take are just totally like, screw it. Like, might as well just pull up with two guys in my face. And granted, like, Klay Thompson and Steph Curry can do that because they're two of the greatest shooters of all time, but they are taking their don't give a shit levels to historic proportions this year.
Yeah, and you actually spent a lot of time arguing with me before this season about whether or not they were actually entertaining to watch. And mm-hmm. I will say that while they've played a lot more competitive games this year, and they've actually lost more games so far this year than I expected,
yeah,
they have actually been so aggravating to me in terms of how they're conducting themselves in a lot of these first halves that they're not as entertaining as I thought they would be. And I never necessarily thought I was going to say that. But guys, yeah, come on. Like, squandering talent is an absolute sin. Bring it every night. Bring it every quarter.
Well, that's kind of my issue with them, is that they're either screwing around or they play so well that the games are over by halftime and there's not really an in-between with them. Like, honestly, the ideal for me would be for Steve Kerr, like, humanitarian coach of the year, to just sit one of those guys every night to try and level the playing field a little bit. Because when you take Durant off the floor, at least it's a game. Take Draymond off the floor, it's a game. But when they're all out there and actually playing well, I mean, it's like a joke. But you're right that they've been a mess so far.
One final thought to tie up this Oklahoma City situation. If people think we're being too dramatic about this, I just want to underscore right now, the Thunder's offense is ranked 22nd. They're ranked behind the Utah Jazz, who lost Gordon Hayward, have lost Rudy Gobert to injury. And, you know, we were joking earlier in the season, I think, that you were going to be like the starting three for them because they just could not get any scoring whatsoever. They just needed somebody to chuck up some shots. So Utah, this team that's entirely built around defense, glue guys, you know, the Thabo Sefolosha's of the world, is more efficient offensively at this current moment than this superstar-laden Russell Westbrook, Paul George, Carmelo Anthony, Big Three model that the Thunder have put together. That is a big problem.
Yeah, and can I tie this up with two theories that I really enjoyed this weekend regarding the Thunder? The first one's about the Thunder. A Warriors fan posited that the Warriors lost on purpose to convince Russ that he doesn't need to change the way he's playing, which I love, consistent with their light years philosophy. And then the second one is that Draymond sat on purpose when the Warriors played the Bulls so that Jordan Bell would get a chance to go against the team that traded him on draft night.
No, I definitely think they sat Draymond for sure for that exact reason. I lied. I have one more Thunder take that I want to share with you. This is coming actually from a former player I was talking to at a game last night. Longtime NBA player, you know, big time scorer in the league. Not going to be a Hall of Famer, but, you know, a guy with chops. he told me that the way Westbrook sort of approached the season early in terms of, you know, intentionally seeking the balance. I mean, you remember after a couple of weeks where like he, Melo, and Paul George were all averaging like the same scoring down to the decimal. And right. It was like really, really strange. Not only is that unorthodox for Westbrook to try to play that way and to try to force it, he was saying that as a supporting guy, it puts tons more pressure on you because you feel like, oh, he's passing me the ball when he doesn't really want to, or he wouldn't normally. So therefore, you better do something good with it. You better score. Or alternatively, you better give it right back to him. It just puts you in your own head as a complimentary player because it doesn't feel natural. It doesn't have that traditional flow. And it's also, if you've played with him from previous seasons, it's not how you know he prefers to play, right? So what he's saying is that there's a trickle-down effect from, you know, Westbrook maybe overthinking things that kind of, you know, extends to the other players. Now, whether that's Paul George or just some of the other role guys, you know, he didn't necessarily specify that. But I think there is some truth to that. And I do think that, you know, when we're looking at this whole Billy Donovan thing, I think the biggest adjustment the Thunder could make is to just say, you know what, Russ, just be you. You know, forget about all this overthinking. Don't worry about Melo getting his shots. You know, keep in mind you've got Paul George on your team, but just go nuts. I mean, I think that's the most logical, like, major change that they can make midseason here. And we'll see if that's what happens.
Yeah, it's going to be an adventure. Like, the next couple months, there's going to be a lot of ups and a lot of dark nights in Oklahoma City, just because I think it's an awkward fit. And we'll see who survives. Billy Donovan absolutely could be gone. And they could say, look, Russ, go back to shooting 25 shots a game. Paul George isn't going to be here in a year. So, like, let's just do what you do best. And they could, like, Paul George getting traded is not entirely out of the question. And that's a possibility that you have thrown out there before. And it's crazy, but, like, if things get dark enough and the Cavs put that Brooklyn pick on the table, it's at least a possibility.
For sure. And in the big picture, it's not like they're 13th in the Western Conference. They're right on the playoff bubble. They've had really, you know, bad luck and bad execution in late game scenarios. That should still improve. So this isn't a crisis, but, you know, it really is just, are they going to be an elite team in the West or not? And to me, the flaws have been so glaring. We just got to say they're not.
I maintain that they'll be in the second round of the playoffs and won't get any further than that. But we should move on. We've had a lot of pent-up takes. We've had a week off here. Before we do, a word from our sponsors, Movement Watches. Today's show is brought to you by Movement Watches. We get it. Holiday shopping can be tough. But thanks to Movement, all that gift-giving anxiety can disappear with the press of a button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life, guy or girl, and they start at only $95. Ben, talk to me about Movement watches.
If there's one thing I've always despised, it's watch middlemen. Movement watches came along, got rid of all of them. It's direct from them to you, no added markups. That's why you get this amazing value, $95 entry-level price point. Boom, your wrist now looks like it has a $400 or a $500 watch. The reason why I love Movement, it's versatile. It sticks with me everywhere. If I'm going to Staples Center for a game, if I'm heading out to the forest for a nice walk, if I'm just walking around my neighborhood, you know, getting coffee, whatever it might be, Movement's got different looks for all of those situations. They've got you covered. And it's affordable. And by the way, it's a great holiday gift. Put it on your own gift list. You know, find someone you might actually care about in your life. Go ahead and throw them a watch. It's going to be a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, it's versatile for you, and it's versatile as a gift because you really can give it to anybody. So check out movement.com, MVMT.com. You can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmt.com/floor. Check it out, join the movement, support Open Floor, and simplify your holiday shopping. That's the main thing. So, all right, let's get back into it. So, Grizzlies, David Fizdale is out. What the hell is happening down there? What are you seeing?
Well, the first thing is just big picture, like, this is a guy who made his name standing up for his players. You know, the famous take that for Dada rant. He wasn't just like yelling. He was trying to get foul calls for his guys, right? So that's sort of how people know him. And then it just seems to me kind of ironic, the first time there's this major public clash where, you know, Gasol's kind of taking some shots at him. And apparently, you know, league sources, they all say, okay, there was some friction there behind the scenes, no question about it, kind of precipitating this. It's the first time they really go at it in public. Instead of having the organization say, okay, well, this guy's all about loyalty, he's about his players, let's sit everybody down and figure this out, they just completely kicked him to the curb and moved forward. To me, that was not the best way to handle it. It will probably make a tough situation worse. The main reason that I didn't like the decision to fire Fizdale is because it's so obvious why they're struggling right now. I mean, Mike Conley goes down, they lose seven straight.
Yeah.
That's as clear as it gets. You know, you're a two-player team. One of your players is out. The other player is going through a shooting slump in Marc Gasol. Yeah, you're going to be losing a lot of games. And so to me, you know, J.B. Bickerstaff had this happen to him before in Houston, where you just kind of get handed the situation.
It's a rough deal for J.B. Bickerstaff, man.
No, he's being set up for failure. And okay, let's just say that Marc Gasol does bounce back and have a career year because the coach is gone. What's the ceiling of this squad given the type of players that they're playing? Because remember, like, their lead ball handlers right now are Mario Chalmers, who wasn't in the NBA last year because he was injured, and Tyreek Evans, who, you know,
hey, look,
it hurts him to pass the ball. Okay, he's a great scorer. I can understand. Okay, people are putting him in like the sixth man of the year conversation or whatever. The guy is not going to be your point guard. It's just not going to work. Everyone's going to be frustrated by that. So how does firing the coach solve those fundamental roster issues? I don't get it.
Tyreek Evans is a bucket getter after my own heart, and I will not have Tyreek slander on this podcast. He's having a great year, back from the dead. So that's number one. But I agree with everything else you said. It's funny, man. You talk about their injuries. I can't remember whether I've told this story on the podcast before, so stop me if I have. But basically, last year, before the season began, we had to do those scouting interviews for the anonymous scouts takes. And I did my interview. One of the teams I had to do was the Grizzlies. And the scout I talked to was like, yeah, they're going to be a good team if all those guys can stay healthy, but they're not going to stay healthy. So that's sort of the end of the story. And then I submitted it to the editors, and the editors were like, this isn't enough. We need to say something good about the Grizzlies. We need to say something nice. And I came back to the scout, and he's like, what do you want me to say? Like, they're not going to be healthy. It's obvious to everyone that Gasol is slowing down. Conley has had injury issues in the past few years, and Parsons was hurt when they signed him. So we had to sort of like really search for positives with the Grizzlies, because it was just clear to everyone that this is how this was going to end. And so to me, like, and you're right about Fizdale, because what one of the things, like, everyone around the league loves this dude, and you saw it after he was fired yesterday, and I heard it even before he had coached a game in Memphis. Like, he's one of the only guys who have had people sort of come out of the woodwork and say, like, David Fizdale is a great dude. He's a smart guy. He's great with players, and people really like him. And I think this is a win for him. Like, there are a lot of people saying he got screwed, but like, he is able to sort of jump off the ship before things get really dark in Memphis.
Yeah, and you look at his tenure. I mean, he took some steps to modernizing, right? Like, he way emphasized the three-pointer. He encouraged Mike to shoot more. He encouraged Mark to shoot more. He broke up that big ball tandem of Mark and Zach. I mean, there was really no way that was going to be an ideal way to play sort of in 2017-18 pace and space. So yeah, he figured that out. He made the right steps, but the problem is the Grizzlies are kind of in quicksand, right? Like, all those forward progress steps, but you're sinking backwards because your main guys are getting a little bit older because of the injury issues and because of just the revolving door of supporting cast members who, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, we're going to shoot a lot more three-pointers, but when you look at the guys on their team who are shooting those threes, I mean, you're not going to win games with those guys, especially if Parsons is, you know, missing a lot of time last season. So it was just a kind of a quicksand effect where, like, his progress, you know, as sort of admirable as it was, wasn't really leading to progress in the standings because of these factors. And again, that's not going to reverse because he's gone. And so to me, that's a tough job for anyone who wants to step into it. And I think for their front office, it's time to start wondering, you know, what kind of trade scenarios can you put together by February But I think the real question is, I mean, how much value does a guy like Marc Gasol or even Mike Conley have on the trade market given their salary numbers? Are they viewed as assets, as positive players? Or is it almost a situation where they're making so much money and their projected value for you over the duration of those contracts is waning that they're not even necessarily assets? I think it's a fair question, especially when you look at how much stars went for last summer, when guys who were on shorter contracts, you know, really didn't get you know, that big of offers in terms of like the Jimmy Butlers and the Paul Georges.
Yeah.
Even if you wanted to trade Marc Gasol and Mike Conley, like, what can you get for them? And I think it's, you know, pretty fair to say, you know, doubtfully that much.
Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the things I've seen a lot of people talk about, how the Grizzlies should have seen this coming and should have blown it up a year or two earlier. And I just don't really agree. I don't think they had that option, because I think what's true about Gasol and Conley now was also true 2 years ago. Like, they have been Ben Golliver all-stars for 5 years now, but teams around the league were not going to give up a whole lot for Mike Conley, or they were not going to give up a whole lot for Gasol. They would have given up more for Gasol, but not like a king's ransom that you sort of like build the foundation around. And there was just more value to keeping them in Memphis and staying relevant than there would have been to sort of like restart with a pick at the bottom of the lottery. Like, they weren't going to get top five picks for Gasol or Conley. And so,
no, I hear you.
Like, that's the thing. There've been a lot of people on Twitter just like crapping all over Chris Wallace. And I think that Chris Wallace deserves criticism for other reasons. Like, you go back and look at the draft history in Memphis, and that has been really, really shaky. Like Xavier Henry as a lottery pick in 2010, Hasheem Thabeet. Obviously, that's a easy one to mock in hindsight, but it is also like physically painful to me to imagine how much cooler the Grizzlies would have been with James Harden next to Mike Conley when back during like Zebo's heyday. And they haven't added any real contributors at the back end of that roster, to the point where like that's one of the reasons they had to sign Parsons. They were desperate and they needed to sort of like take a big swing. And I mean, that was an idiotic deal at the time, but like they were sort of in try anything mode to keep this going.
Yeah, one other one that you didn't mention more recently is Wade Baldwin. You know, that's a first-round pick you use on a point guard, and you cut him from your roster this year. He can't even make the team.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a disaster. After 1 year, and you don't even bring him back, I mean, that's crazy. And you look at some of the other, you know, backup-level point guards who were drafted either in that draft or in this year's draft who are giving minutes and capably stepping in. Like, Mike Conley goes down. Wouldn't it be great to have a first-round pick from 2 years ago to plug in as your point guard and run the show? Well, nope.
Yeah, it really hurts, man. And yeah, I don't know how much this could have been avoided. Like, I think this is just sort of part of the life cycle with NBA teams. Like, you're seeing it happen with the Clippers as well, where like you can run it out for an extra year or two and make the playoffs and have fun, although it wasn't that fun in LA. But like, I think it's going to happen with the Raptors in a year or two as well. Like, it's just going to get dark at the end, and you're going to end up trading good players for like 30 cents on the dollar. And that's like how good teams end. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like a criticism of the front office. Like, in Memphis, they would have fallen off the map for 5 years.
No question. Look, they made the playoffs 7 years in a row in the West. Let's give them a lot of credit for doing that. Don't lose that in the shuffle at all. I mean, that is no small accomplishment, and it's not inconceivable they sneak in as like the eighth seed this year, you know, depending on Conley's health and what, you know, other teams who are getting injured and so forth. So there are much worse situations out there, but in terms of the bleakness factor looking forward, there's no doubt. It's like you're kind of, you know, standing off the edge of the cliff looking down, and, you know, it hasn't hit you yet, but, you know, you realize you're going to get pushed here pretty soon just because of age. Hey, I want to drill down real quick on the Fizdale decision to sit Gasol in the fourth quarter, because I was talking to a bunch of different people around the league about that yesterday and got all sorts of conflicting responses. So basically, they're in the middle of a set. They've lost seven straight games. They're playing the Nets. The Nets love to go to these small, wacky lineups, super interchangeable. The Grizzlies bench puts together this big run in the fourth quarter to kind of get Memphis back in the game. And instead of going back to Mark, Fizdale just rides a small look, kind of in a matchup situation with Brooklyn, leaving Gasol on the bench throughout crunch time. He doesn't ever come back in, which is very unusual, if not completely unprecedented,
right?
During Gasol's sort of like prime years there in Memphis. And that's sort of what was the precipitating event for all this back and forth between him and Fizdale that wound up with Fizdale getting fired. What did you make of Fizdale's coaching decision to do that? I heard from someone who's been around the league in a long time who said basically that should be viewed as a fireable offense. When you're a one-man team like Gasol is in Memphis, you should get to say that you're on the court. And if you don't, then that's just basically kind of like Fizdale's heat check, where he's always honest to a fault, and he's always very principled and understands where he's coming at things. Everybody knows you're not getting any BS from him. He's a kind of a straight talk type of guy. It's like a little too straight talk with that move of being like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna like test my guy. Like, did he fly too close to the sun on that one?
I guess so. I mean, first of all, I have zero sources in Memphis. I have people around the league that I talk to, but really, like, the Grizzlies have been off my radar for years. So I'm only going off what's been reported elsewhere. Like, I think Jonathan Givony came out and said that there have been issues with Gasol and Fizdale in the past. So to me, like, I think it's hard to divorce what happened in Brooklyn from what was supposedly happening last spring and over the summer. Like, there have been clashes along the way. So I think that was sort of like Fizdale taking it a step further. And the thing with Gasol, Gasol's been playing like crap for the last couple of weeks, and it's not entirely his fault. Obviously, the Grizzlies are shorthanded, but like, I don't blame any coach who's going to sit a player in the fourth quarter. And I guess what you're getting at is that just the way the NBA works, that's like a cardinal sin. And to me, I don't think it should be.
Yeah, I'm not totally persuaded by that person's argument. Kind of see Gasol's side, because if there was like capable other options, maybe it wouldn't have been so frustrating. And I hate to name drop Tim Duncan here twice on the same podcast. It's sort of like the model of like NBA wisdom. But remember during the finals, like, Popovich pulled him. They lost the finals because Popovich outsmarted himself and took Duncan off the court for a situation where they needed to get that key rebound. Did Duncan go to the media and blast Popovich for the awkward situation and like freak out and say how angry he was and do all the things that Marc Gasol did? No, of course not. He came back and won a title the next year because he's Tim Duncan. These kinds of situations, hey, it's true.
Yo, I mean, facts, we could release a podcast. Only. Honestly, we could release a separate podcast with you talking about Tim Duncan, and it would be the most insufferable shit in the world. But all of it is sincere. Like, you truly do. Duncan is in your top three all time.
No, facts only. And the reason why I say this is because, look, it's easy to say after the fact, oh, this is the red line that a coach can't cross. You can't be benching your best guy during the crunch time. Well, guess what? Coaches and stars have friction behind the scenes all the time. Giannis practically killed the assistant coach last week in Milwaukee on national television in front of everybody. And these things happen, right? So why was this a situation where management and ownership decided that like it was a completely unforgivable sin? Again, I guess I'm siding on Fizdale's side here, saying, look, this wasn't that unusual. It was a weird decision. He probably should have communicated it better. It would have been nice if he had a real solid, like, small ball center that he was going to, that he really made the decision more defensible, because the other pieces there aren't great. But this wasn't like some travesty of justice where, he's like putting Marc Gasol out for, the entire season because it's so hard on him. And boy, how can the superstar be forced to take this? I don't think it was quite that dramatic.
Well, couple reactions. First of all, it does remind me of when Kevin McHale benched James Harden for that Clippers comeback and then got fired like 2 months later. But I do think, like, if you're the GM or you're the owner and you see that happening between your star player and your coach, like, it makes sense to fire the coach. And so that's why, like, I Fizdale's decision in Brooklyn, I'm fine with, but like, I'm also fine with Memphis saying, look, this isn't working and we need to try something different. So Fizdale, you got to go. Because I do think it's the coach's responsibility to foster a healthy relationship with the superstar. And by all accounts, the dynamics with Gasol, like, were not in a good place at this point. And
I love how you phrase that, foster a successful relationship, because what you really are saying through the coded language is cater. It's a coach's job to cater. In the NBA, it's true. And you're 100% right. And that's exactly what we just talked about with Donovan and Westbrook. I mean, let's try to imagine the situation where Westbrook goes out there and does something so ridiculous on the final possession of a game that Billy Donovan actually comes at him hard and criticizes him in the public. Like, what would Westbrook have to do? Like, take the basketball, run through the concourse, maybe like jump on the trampoline that they use during timeouts. Punt it, you know, would he have to punt it into the 300 level, shoot it out of a t-shirt cannon? I mean,
dude, I don't know. And it's not that different with John Wall and Scott Brooks. I mean, like, everybody has to sort of tread lightly when they're talking about the franchise guy. And that's the way it should be to some degree. I also think that it's a real skill for coaches who are able to actually coach their superstars and do it in a way that's respectful and leaves them feeling empowered at the same time. And that, I think, is part of what separates like the truly elite coaches in the NBA from the good coaches. And David Fizdale, like, there was a lot of outrage yesterday. I don't think that he's an elite coach, and that's why I didn't think it was like that big of a problem for Memphis to move on from him. I think he's adored around the NBA, and I think he will catch on somewhere else. Like, I'd love to see him in Phoenix. I'd love to see him with the Clippers maybe, but like, for Memphis, like, they might as well sort of try and see if they can change things up to come back to life here.
Yeah, and I think it puts a lot of pressure on Marc Gasol to step up. I mean, can you imagine if this exact scenario had played out in New York with Melo? I mean, I guess there's some parallels to like Melo and D'Antoni, but like, if Melo had criticized Hornacek last year, yeah, well, and think about how big of a deal that was, and think about how much backlash Melo got throughout all of that. All of that should now be on Gasol. It's time for him to really step up here and, you know, take this team to the playoffs, basically. I mean, I think that's as simple as it gets. I mean, if he doesn't, to me, he comes out of this looking really bad.
Yeah.
I agree what you're saying about, you know, Fizdale. Okay, he's probably not a top 10 coach, but that's not a top 10 job. I mean, there's a reason why they hired him as a first-timer in the first place. They fired multiple coaches after playoff appearances in recent years. The owner shoots YouTube videos of himself shooting jumpers in a shooting sleeve. I mean, this is not like a major destination everybody wants to go play and coach for. So if you find good people like David Fizdale, don't just pop them for no reason in
November. That's fair. The ownership situation is a whole other discussion because Robert Pera has been a little bit of a, I don't even know. I don't want to get into it. But the thing that you mentioned that I do want to get into is that Memphis is not a top 10 destination. And I agree with that. And it's the final piece of this discussion is, like, I was at a playoff game a couple years ago. And before the game, Adam Silver gave a press conference talking about the Grizzlies as like the consummate small market success story in the NBA. Which I think they have been. If you go to Grizzlies games, they are so fun. And for so many years, like, they were impossible to root against because they just were like distinct next to the rest of the league. And they played hard and they had great characters. They marketed the team well and it was awesome. But at the same time, like, we talk about how their options were limited toward the end of this run. And I think it speaks to like structural issues that the NBA has and has had forever, where like a team like Memphis can't afford to blow it up and just like tear things down for a couple years because there may not be a fan base there afterwards. And like, so you can debate whether Grizzlies fans would stay loyal, but what I mean is just that like their business doesn't allow them to operate the way other teams do.
Yeah, it's an uneven playing field. There's no question about it. And also keep in mind that this model small market franchise that Adam Silver is putting out there, their high point was being swept by the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals, right? And is that competitive balance? If you're saying, look, if you do everything right, if you cultivate a great relationship with your fans, if you hit some home runs on draft picks, I mean, Marc Gasol was an absolute steal in terms of that trade. And then Conley is totally paid off. You do everything right, you will be able to get swept by the Spurs, or you'll be able to like crack the conference finals once during a 7-year window. That's tough, man.
To be fair, they didn't do everything right. And I think that's the real issue with small market franchises.
That's how he's pitching them though, right? Like he's trying to say like, look, they've got all their stuff together. They've got a great relationship with the community. And what I'm saying is, look, if you really are doing things right off the court and you have a couple of stars, you'd like to think you'd be able to compete for a title. And we've never been able to say that about Memphis. And I just think it kind of pushes back on Silver's argument. You know, I don't think that this is that level of a playing field. I don't have a huge problem with it. I just don't think we should
I don't either. I do think, though, once you start digging into the dynamics in Memphis, it does highlight just like a bigger issue with the NBA that's been a reality for a while. And to me, the exact problem is that as a small market team trying to win in the NBA, you basically can't make a single mistake or a single big mistake. And like the beat over Harden was a big mistake, and the Parsons contract was a big mistake, and that was it. Like the Grizzlies are screwed now. But we'll see. Well, hopefully they can get it together. Who knows? I don't want to end on that dark note with our Memphis chapter here, but it is going to be tricky. On a brighter note and a brighter small market note, we have a couple more things I want to cover before the podium.
Well, here's a bright way to spin this Grizzlies thing as a closing.
Okay.
You always wonder about Mike Conley's value because, you know, casual fans like you and fantasy nerds, they tend to overlook him and underrate him. Conley couldn't even leave the court for 2 weeks without his coach getting fired, okay? That's how valuable he is. You take him off the court, the whole thing went kaput very quickly. So let's give Mike Conley his due.
Sweet
his acclaim
vindication
is never going
for
to
Ranger
imagine.
Rick.
Hey, stop it. His acclaim is never going to match his impact. I understand that. But this right here tells you how good of a player he is.
Good. Well, I'm happy for you. I'm glad that you have your moment in the sun as the Grizzlies sort of sink into the earth here. But let's talk about the Pistons real quick, because they looked awesome against the Celtics on Monday night. And Andre Drummond, we talked about it a little bit on the podcast last week, but like, he looks like a completely different player this year. Tobias Harris could be for real. Like, maybe this is just who he is now, and he actually can shoot threes and is like reasonably efficient. Reggie Jackson, I refuse to trust, but like, the Pistons might actually be a top four team in the East, which is kind of unbelievable to me.
Yeah, my takeaway from that game was less Detroit positivity and more Celtics negativity. Surprise, surprise. But man, they're soft in the middle, right? I mean, we've seen them get punished by big centers over and over. That's their Achilles heel. That's their matchup weakness. And maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe they can still get through to the Eastern Conference Finals. But if you're soft in the middle, LeBron will punish you, period. And so to me, when I see Andre Drummond going for 20-20s against Boston's frontline, it's impressive on one level. And by the way, the most impressive part of that game was him intercepting the inbounds pass, tipping it ahead to himself, taking one dribble from
half court.
It was
crazy.
And dunking and one. I mean, Andre Drummond, where did this come from? Your nose is looking so much, your nasal passages are so much more effectively cleared this year than last year, apparently. Like, that was just an unreal highlight.
Honestly, but, man, I think it was just that highlight. I watched the whole game, but it was just that sequence that kind of blew my mind, and I was like, oh, holy shit, maybe the Pistons are really good. And you're probably right. It was a case of Al Horford making Andre Drummond look superhuman. The one other thing that I really did like, though, so in the wake of the Celtics summer, there were a lot of people in Boston and even around the league who were downplaying Avery Bradley's defense and talking about how, you know, like, the metrics sort of will tell you a different story than what your eyes do, and he's really not that effective on that end, and the Celtics were better with Marcus Smart in there. I'm not here to debate the utility of metrics, but Avery Bradley is a fucking awesome defender. And I can't seriously talk basketball with anybody who disagrees. And he was a pest with Kyrie all night and was just very active back in Boston. And it was awesome to see him vindicated a little bit.
Yeah, when he plays on-ball defense, it's sort of like he's like a shadow of the ball handler, or like they're dance partners and he's just mimicking like move for move. Like he's just got that footwork and that quick reaction down so pat. I would say, though, don't always judge a guy's ability when he plays against his former team. You know, that could be misleading. We see guys step up their energy level like quite a bit. Not necessarily saying that he does that, but that did come to my mind, you know, as I was kind of checking in on that game. Yeah, in terms of Drummond, well, he must have heard us say that he's going to be an all-star snub, and he responds with a 2020.
He looks awesome. He really does. And they, like, look, we'll see where it goes with the Pistons, but you're right. Avery Bradley is sort of like the closest thing the NBA has to a shutdown corner, and he's just a lot of fun to watch. So I've always had a soft spot for him. We should move on. A quick dispatch from Clippers Lakers last night. We have one Lakers question and one Clippers question. So first from Stefan, he says, "Hey guys, I am a frustrated Lakers fan. What greater issues do you guys see? The comeback on the Bulls squad was cute, but getting blown out by the Kings was not acceptable under any circumstances, and then they lost again to the Clippers last night. So what are you seeing with the Lakers?"
Well, they are very young. They've got a point guard who can't shoot, and that's going to lead to significant inconsistency, period. Like, there's not really any other. You can go and analyze every last thing, you know, down to the end. I mean, if that's who you are, you're going to have up nights, you're going to have down nights. They let one get away against the Clippers, there's no question. To me, the biggest thing that stands out about these Lakers is the confidence level. Guys like Kuzma and Ingram, they're really feeling themselves right now. I mean, Ingram attacking off the dribble last night, even late in games, was very impressive. He's starting to really figure it out in a big-time way. Kuzma is just an assassin, man. That guy is trying to put 20 points on your head every single night. Yeah. I do hear the Lakers fans who are griping about him maybe being buried a little bit by Luke Walton in certain situations. He's coming off the bench. It might be time to just pencil him in as a starter and just go forward with that as your new, you know, modus operandi. The Lonzo thing continues to be tricky. I mean, there's not really any way around it. Like, there's lots of situations where they are coming up empty on offense simply because he can't shoot. He can't hit open shots. He trusts his shot more than he can. And he's simultaneously like kind of overconfident in terms of his shot selection, but then totally unconfident in his shot execution, if that makes sense, which is a bad combo. To me, the Lakers are kind of on track. You know, I don't really understand where the frustration is coming from their fans. I can't say that they're drastically underperforming at all. You know, I think they're right there. I have heard some whispers around town, like Julius Randle, maybe some trade requests, maybe some.
Julius Randle can be frustrated. The rest of Lakers fans, because it's not just Stefan. It's also like I follow a lot of Lakers fans on Twitter, and I've traditionally been like a closet Lakers fan over the last 10 or 15 years. Like, I like when they are good. And the one thing that's been weird to me this year is after every Lakers loss, Lakers fans are just like miserable and so pissed off at Luke Walton and his rotations. And like, somebody last night was like, "I'm going to bed. I'll discuss this in the morning." And like, I just don't really get it. Like, don't you people realize that the Lakers are not going to actually be like for real good this year? And that's not a problem. Like, they're young and building.
Well, look, they're coming at the sport from a different angle than you. You're used to bad teams. Okay.
That's
true. A Wizards fan. These guys are used to racking up 60 wins and titles. And, the days aren't quite as dark as they were a few years ago, and I think that's led maybe to a little bit of a fan overcorrection. In terms of the Clippers side, it was a weird night. So I was like standing in the hallway, you know, kind of waiting for the media session to happen. And Lou Williams had his third career 40-point game, his first as a Clipper, and he was being like serenaded by a few fans on his way off the court. And Steve Ballmer was just completely elated, like hugging Lou, like Ballmer's whole family's there, like waiting so that Ballmer can like have this moment of like gratitude for Lou for kind of saving the game and obviously having such a huge scoring performance. And then as Ballmer kind of like turns the corner, he's like, well, now we got to go figure out what's up with Blake. And it's like, that is basically the story of the entire Clippers franchise for the last 5 or 6 years. Like, no matter what good could possibly happen, a Blake Griffin injury or someone else's injury is kind of lurking right around that corner.
Right.
And Blake, you know, as we're taping this, it's sounding like he has a sprained MCL, so he probably avoided like a major surgery.
He could miss some significant time.
Yeah, weeks, you know, if not months. They have no way to replace him, Andrew. There is nothing on this roster that says like, oh, we're going to be able to just like get by okay without Blake. And I think this is really going to heighten a lot of the issues we talked about earlier in terms of Doc's future, in terms of a DeAndre Jordan trade potentially, in terms of maybe pursuing tanking. You take Blake off this team, especially if Gallinari's not back, I don't know how you score other than just trusting Lou Will to shoot 30 times a night.
Yeah.
And then defensively, it gets a lot trickier too.
Yeah. And look, the Blake injury would be a bigger deal if it, like, I think everybody has seen this coming. Like, it's not surprising to really anyone who's been paying close attention over the last couple years. And even coming into this year, we said, like, we'll see how long they can stay healthy, but it's not looking great. It's basically Grizzlies West here. And it's a bummer. And we talked about some of the bigger questions that'll raise a couple podcasts ago. But first, let's move to the podium here. So we've got a couple questions. First is from Allie. He says, dude, you guys pronounced libero as bad as possible. The emphasis is on the first and third vowel. Love the pod, but have to well actually you on that one. Shouts from Germany. Keep up the good work. So I think he's saying it's pronounced libero, not libero. And I am not surprised at all that I completely butchered the pronunciation. I still love libero as our unicorn alternative. What do you think?
Well, actually, I believe his name is Ali, not Ali. So I think that people need to just lay off your pronunciations. You have a lot of skills as a podcast host. You're an unbelievable setup guy. You're prepared. You've got a good rundown. Lots of logic involved. Pronunciation, okay, we're going to say that might be an area that needs
improvement. It's a real weakness. Have I ever told you my placebo story?
You're excuse me? What did you say?
All right, so back in the day, I was in probably ninth grade, and I was in a drama class, and we were reading a play, and it was like a 50-person class, and I had to stand up to read my part. And so I'm going through, I'm really getting into it, putting a little extra English on the on all my lines, and I come to this scene, and I say, the old placebo in front of the entire class, and the correct word was obviously placebo, and the entire class burst out laughing, making fun of me. And I think it was a traumatic experience that has given me more anxiety going forward with all pronunciations in the present day. And so that's where it all started. So just thank you for bearing with me. Open floor.
Bottom line. Ali, I hope you feel terrible for what you've just done. I mean, look at this wound that you have opened up. I mean, that sounds awful. I'm getting anxiety over here just listening to this story. Ali, thanks for nothing. No, in terms of the pronunciation, libero is what we're trying to do. Is that,
yes.
Am I saying that one right?
I think so. I actually went to YouTube and researched it a little bit, and there are a bunch of videos on there of questionable provenance, but I think libero is the correct one.
So I also checked in with one of our soccer experts, a guy named David Amoyle. He's had me on his podcast a couple times to see who is the real libero of the NBA. And what he basically said was we weren't quite working with the correct definition.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying it's more of a defensive-minded player who sort of floats around on defense, but then pushes the attack forward on offense, as opposed to being just somebody who's like totally playing free of all strictures. So in that scenario, we're more talking about like a Draymond Green, you know, where he's like coming over for that crazy like weak side help, swats a shot, and then takes off and pushes the fast break for Golden State. So I think that's more like the technically correct definition. But I think in the grand scheme of being Americans, in terms of mispronouncing words and just, you know, taking someone else's culture and misappropriating it, right. I think we should just still stick with our definition of libero being, you know, point forwards who are just all over the place.
Yeah,
and roll with
well,
that.
And look, Draymond is a unicorn as well. He's a unicorn on the low, so that works for me. And the bottom line is that we're trying, which I think is all the rest of the world is asking for from Americans. So we're making an effort here, and thank you for bearing with us. But let's move on. Speaking of traumatic experiences, Joseph says, the Wizards' collapse last night against the Hornets came on the heels of the Redskins' collapse against the Saints. DC sports are destroying my will to live. Along these no heaven without hell lines, Ben, who do you root for? As far as I can tell, you're a fan of the league and you root for quote-unquote good basketball. You like the Warriors and you're a huge Durant mark, but you also like LeBron and respect his greatness. You like the Bucks, but only the Giannis part. Same with the Sixers and Simmons and Embiid. You like Portland as a city and its alumnus Brandon Roy. And to all this, I say, erroneous, erroneous, erroneous on all counts. You have to choose. You must choose a team, choose a city, and perpetually ride or die with them. That's sports. That's what living is. What's your response, Ben?
I have that team. It's Michigan football. And thanks for bringing that up, because John O'Korn threw a 75-yard pass on a 30-yard play to lose the most important game of the season against Ohio State. And that's really all I think my heart, my mind, and my body can handle. I don't think I can invest any more heavily in another sporting team. And also, you know, Joseph, I understand what you're saying here. There's no question about it. That is sports, but that's not necessarily sports journalism. Like, you get yourself into some real pickles if you start fanning out and standing out like my co-host here, Andrew. I don't want the flood of 6,000 Celtics fans emails calling me biased and everything else for revealing that.
I've gotten into so many pickles. It's really not worth it, but I've come too far to turn back now.
The pickled greased pig, that's what we've always called you. I'm punting on all of those debates.
Football is most of the time. Yeah, look, I'm happy for you. I'm happy for you that you have one team, because that is really all you need. I'm pretty much a liberated fan of college football, and I love it. It's a much better way to enjoy sports. But I have the Wizards, and that's really all I need to drive me completely insane. But you do. It is like it's suffering with the hope of eventual salvation. It's probably never going to get here for me or Joseph as DC sports fans, but it's the journey that makes it worth it. So I'm glad you're experiencing that with John O'Korn and Jim Harbaugh.
I also think it's a kind of a geographic thing too. If you grow up in a city that has a team in every league, I think it's easier to just root for all of those teams, right? Like, if you have a football team, you have a basketball team and so forth. In Portland, it was kind of like the Blazers or bust. And for whatever reason, I just gravitated towards Jordan, probably because, you know, I was force-fed all the Nike marketing, you know, pumped into my veins from an early age. So I didn't go all in on the Blazers standing as deeply as maybe I could have. But the other thing I'd say too, and this is more serious, like, if you cover a team for years, doesn't matter what team it is, that will beat the fan out of you 99 times out of 100.
Yeah.
Just because you know the personalities involved, you understand the money decisions, you know the conflicts behind the scenes and all of that. And that goes for just about any writer, any sport, anywhere. You'll just get not sick of it, but you'll have a healthy distance that maybe didn't exist before. Unless you're just kind of going there as just like a full, you know, fan blogger, in which case that's a little different. But That would be my
I'm surviving.
Intellectual.
I'm surviving. The Wizards are pushing me to the brink, but I'm holding strong for now. Two more questions here. Brock says, after a gluttonous Thanksgiving meal last night, I decided to get some exercise and go on a solo hike in the mountains outside Boulder, Colorado. Things started off pretty well, but as I got deeper into the woods and farther away from civilization, I got to thinking about bears, mountain lions, and moose, which are apparently very dangerous. I was feeling a little bit unnerved, and then I saw some tracks, which were probably from a dog, but were also definitely a mountain lion. I admit it. I then got very scared, and instead of talking to myself to scare away potential predators, I decided to listen to your rehash of the Top 100 pod as my bear/lion/moose deterring companion for the remainder of the hike. I made it back to my car, and all potential predators were scared away by Ben's continued Devin Booker hate. Thank you guys for saving my life. Really, really happy for you, Brock. Ben, do you have a response?
I have so many responses. First of all, moose are definitely dangerous, so you do not want to mess with the moose, especially don't get in between the mother and the baby moose, whatever they're called, I forget. Secondly, mountain lions might be a myth because I have seen signs for mountain lions all over the country. I've never seen a mountain lion. I've never met someone who has seen a mountain lion, and I've actually asked like national park rangers, both Rick and Ricketts, you know, male and female rangers. None of them have ever seen mountain lions in person. So I wouldn't worry about the mountain lion part of it.
Uh-huh.
One time I did stare down a deer in Utah face to face for an hour because I was somewhere I wasn't supposed to be, and I was kind of like in his meadow, and he was in between me and my car, and I couldn't get back to my car, so I just waited, and he waited me out, and it was just an hour-long waiting match. So I understand Brock's conundrum here personally. The one thing I'd say, though, we had a story from that guy who his cell phone was returned to him by the cabbie because our voices were coming through.
Right.
And like the cabbie was just like so turned off by our voices that he brought the guy's like $800 cell phone back to him just so he didn't have to be with us. If I was him, I think I would have just cranked up the podcast on speaker to scare all animals away. Like, don't you think we would repulse mountain lions and moose if we were just screaming? If he was hearing us, you know, break down like, you know, Alfred Payton at you know, in the 90s of the Top 100, or kind of like gushing over Ben Simmons' developing as a playmaker. If I'm a moose, I'm out. I don't want anything to do with that.
Yeah, it's not a bad theory. It's certainly worth a try. I have two things to add. First of all, I've had a very similar experience to your deer story where I got lost. It was a classic like city person thing. I was in Virginia in it like 2 hours away, and my GPS took me onto someone's farm, and I was on like a ridge, and there were a pack of bulls above me and a pack of bulls below me. And they kind of like blocked my road for about 45 minutes, and I had no cell reception, and I just had to sit there and hope that these bulls didn't like knock my Volkswagen down the ridge. So that was like the closest near-death nature experience I had. And the second
no
thing...
No wonder you hate national parks, man.
I'm good, man. Leave me in the city. I'm all set down here in D.C.,
this has been a real emotional journey with you today. I mean, first of all, we've got you on stage. Now we've got bulls charging you. I am really sympathetic. And normally I want to scream at you. This is great.
Yeah, this is like therapy today. The only other thing I wanted to say is that, one, congrats to Brock for exercising after Thanksgiving dinner. That is incredible to me. And the other thing, did you see the picture that he embedded? It was of a giant paw print, and that was not a dog. There were definitely, I don't know whether that's a moose print, I don't know whether that's a bear or a mountain lion, but that was not a dog. So he was right to be on his toes as he was getting out of there that night.
Well, the last thing I'd say here is that just remember, Brock, you know, animals and nature have existed for thousands of years, right? They don't necessarily worry
about
us.
You're a guest, Brock.
Yeah, you're a guest in their home. So you just do you, you know, don't go out of your way to mess with them. And most likely they will all leave you alone and just go about their own business. They're probably listening to the Low Post podcast. You know, the beer is probably, three, two, one. The bear's probably got his own, you know, basketball podcast and his headphones. He's not really too worried about you and the rest of Open Floor Globe, and that's fine. You know, you do you.
Good. All right, last question here, which is definitely one of the weirdest questions we've ever had. Alex says, "Hey guys, I just wanted to share a little recap of a dream I had last night. Ben Golliver moved into my neighborhood. I go over to introduce myself as any good neighbor does. We're talking, I complain about some back pain and a pain in my hand, Next thing I know, Ben is giving me a wine massage where he dips my hand in wine and then massages it. I don't know if this is a real thing, but damn, did it work. It felt great. Ben and I struck up quite the friendship talking about basketball and growing up in Portland. In this dream world, Ben, you are really killing it. Congrats on your beautiful dream wife, dream house, dream furniture, and being only 25 years old. I hope we can hang out in my dreams again soon. And he added some questions, but first I'm going to let you respond to the wine massage.
Well, here's the thing. His dream scenario sounds basically like my worst nightmare. So just to be 100% clear, I'm not a wine masseuse. I have no interest in becoming a wine masseuse. I don't like liquor really at all. I don't drink liquor. I don't like really being around it. I don't like being around drunk people. I certainly would never deign to use liquor as ointment under any circumstances. And I don't want the smell on my hands. I just don't want to have anything to do with the wine part of it. And then because you've been so open and honest about your feelings today, Andrew, I'm going to reciprocate here.
Uh-huh.
I need to admit that I have very sensitive skin, like incredibly sensitive skin. I'm not really into touching strangers. I don't really like to be touched by strangers. I'll dap people up on the street, you know, that's no problem. But past that, I'm really not into, you know, any of that stuff. So the idea of like my hands on a stranger's hands is anathema. I don't want to have anything to do with that. Throw in the wine on top of it. I mean, this...
You're out entirely.
It's terrible. Alex, I mean, please have a better dream here. And in terms of like his questions, like, have we ever had basketball dreams? I can never remember my dreams. My mom had the same problem. She kept a dream journal for years. I have really thought about doing that. Occasionally, I'll like wake up, get my iPhone out, and jot a couple of notes. I dream about basketball and basketball writers and basketball media and players and all that stuff all the time in various weird situations. But then when I wake up, I don't remember it. So it's, you know, a little unfortunate. But Alex, thank you for remembering this dream. I'm sure you can never forget it.
Thank you for sharing it, Alex.
Never forget it. And I have a theory about why he had this dream too, Andrew.
What?
I think he heard me make all these jokes about Aisha's feet, you know, the Steph Curry feet jokes.
Yeah.
I made a couple of those over the last couple of months and how Steph just wants to go home and rub Aisha's feet. And I think that was the seed that blossomed into the tree of his dream.
Yeah, that's a good theory. It could be. A wine massage could be a thing. We don't really know. Probably is it, but like it reminded me, my reaction was to go back to Amari Stoudemire like 3 years ago in that giant tub of red wine, which was apparently therapeutic. So maybe a red wine massage is a real thing. So, but you ducked his question. Have you ever had a dream about me, your co-host?
Oh, I'm sure I have. I mean, there's no question about it. I actually think for podcasters, like we have reached peak annoyingness because I'm sure you do this too in your daily life. Was like, well, on my podcast, I was saying to Andrew, like, or like, you know, to preface whether it's a basketball conversation or whatever else, just in daily life with friends. When I step outside of myself, when I try to reflect, when I try to, you know, play my life with a purpose, not just playing with purpose, when I try to have these moments out in
the
wilderness,
you're the worst.
when I look deep at myself, one of the things that I truly hate is how often I reference this show in daily life. And so from that standpoint, I guarantee you have had tons of dreams about you. I just couldn't tell you what any of them are.
Okay. Well, I am sure I've had dreams about you as well. This podcast is officially in a really, really weird place now. But I've never remembered any of them. If I do, I promise I will share them on the show. A dream that I had recently, actually this morning, I woke up and I was in the middle of a dream where I had been asked to host Saturday Night Live, but I missed an email. So like I didn't find out until Saturday morning, and then I had to like get on the train and go to Saturday Night Live studios in New York City. And I really didn't want to do it. I was like trying to explain to people that I wasn't famous enough and that everyone was going to be pretty weirded out by a random Sports Illustrated writer hosting Saturday Night Live. And they were really into it. They had a Charles Barkley impersonator and we were going to talk basketball on Saturday Night Live. And I probably shouldn't be sharing any of this, but because he asked about dreams, and I rarely remember my dreams, but that actually happened to me this morning. So there you go.
That's fantastic. We have a new mission, Open Floor Globe. We're all keeping dream journals. We're going to follow my mom's advice. Sharp, you're going to keep one. I'm going to keep one. We want your weirdest dreams, especially if they involve one of us.
No, this is not becoming a dream podcast.
Can you top Alex, the wine masseuse? You know, the other thing, too, is like, should we psychoanalyze him? Like, what's going on in his head that he's dreaming about me in this situation?
I have no idea. It's a long NBA season. These are things that happen in the middle. But listen, man.
Hey, look. 5-star reviews on iTunes, right? Isn't that what we said? We're trying to get 10,000 by Christmas. I know you're in. Maybe I should say 10,000 by the holiday season. I know you're in.
I can't wait.
Check me out on Instagram, ben.golliver. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com for all your questions, concerns, comments, feedback, national park recommendations, dream journal entries. And, you know, pity for Sharp. He really opened up pretty deep today. Let's send Andrew some nice thoughts.
The boy who cried placebo. Thank you, Ben. It was fun to get back into it. We will be back on Friday. We were late this week, and I don't know when this is going to go up, but we will be back on Friday on our regular schedule. And Ben, I will talk to you soon, man.
All right, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.